Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. For decades, I've been preaching about the importance of a regimen of basic supplements that everyone should consider part of their daily health routine. So I came up with an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The very same supplements I take myself and prescribe for my patients. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com and check out my Intelligent Medicine Starter Kit. It's a short list of the basic supplements that I recommend as a starting point for those looking to take control of their health. They're the essential elements of a basic program that everyone could benefit from. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about glyphosate, also known as Roundup, and there's a great new book about the history of glyphosate. It's called Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Carrie Gillum is an investigative journalist with many years of excellent reporting, and she's now focusing on agribusiness. This is a big story, Carrie, because recently, Environmental Working Group, EWG, has published a list of all the breakfast foods that we feed to our little kitties. Some of their favorite breakfast foods seem to be laced with glyphosate. Is this potentially a problem?
Well, I'm actually working on a new story, and I've been following research that indicates that, yes, I mean, pesticide residues in foods that we're feeding our kids, look to be a really big problem. The science is fairly new. I guess over the last 10 years, it's really been building. We've had a lot of scientific studies come out just in the last year. But basically what we're learning is that these levels of these chemicals that we've always been told are safe, that our regulators have told us we don't need to worry about, really aren't as safe as we've been told. And the science is telling us that these pesticides are doing damage to fetal brain development, to fertility, in men in particular. Women are having reproductive problems, poor outcomes with live births and gestation terms. So, we're still learning a lot about this. Our regulators tell us not to worry about pesticides in our foods, but our scientists are telling us something different.
You tell many poignant stories in your book, actual accounts of individuals who've experienced problems with this, but one of the most resonating of those is that of Terry McCall, whose husband Jack suffered terribly before dying of cancer in 2015. Can you tell us about the McCalls? What's their story?
Yeah, Terry, sometimes I meet people, and as I try to learn about and tell their stories, it just gets into my heart, and I certainly did with Terry McCall. Her husband, Jack, they'd been married for forever, had this beautiful farm, raised their kids, had their grandkids there, and had fruit trees and avocados. This is out in Cambria, California, and everybody knew Jack. He had been in the war in Vietnam, and it was just a lovely, happy home and family, but he used Roundup. He didn't use anything else on his farm, but he used Roundup because he had been told it was so safe, and sprayed it himself mm-hmm. with a backpack sprayer all around his citrus groves. And first, their family dog, who would romp along beside him, was diagnosed with lymphoma and died. And then Jack himself came down with a rare and very deadly form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma and died the day after Christmas in 2015.
Mm-hmm. So, and there are many other stories like that. And again, anecdotes don't make for a fact pattern because people get sick, but there seems to be a disproportionate amount of this type of cancer, especially in North America, where the use of these chemicals is so pervasive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at the cancer statistics that are compiled by different countries and by world organizations, you see that North America had a particularly steep rise in non-Hodgkin lymphoma. It looked like it had leveled off a little bit in recent years, but you did see quite a jump over the years that glyphosate use was climbing. And non-Hodgkin lymphoma is a disease that our International Agency for Research on Cancer found a particular association to glyphosate. They have deemed glyphosate a probable human carcinogen with a positive association specifically to non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
You know, I have another concern as a physician. These days, the microbiome, the bacteria that inhabit our intestinal tract, are increasingly seen as being very important to many aspects of health. They govern metabolism. There may be a gut-brain connection. There certainly is a relationship to gastrointestinal disorders such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which are on the increase, and on it goes. And I have in front of me a study, and again, no, not a human study, but it's a study in animals. In this study I'm reading here, we investigated the toxic effects of glyphosate-based herbicides on the gut microbiota and its subsequent effects on the neurobehavioral functions in mice. Boy, this is getting kind of profound. It's just trying to see if they affects the brains of the mice. And what they found is that subchronic and chronic exposure to glyphosate induced an increase of anxiety and depression-like behaviors. In addition, it significantly altered the composition of bacteria in the intestine. It decreased certain species. I'm not going to, you know, including lactobacillus, which is actually what people take when they take probiotics, but other species that people haven't heard of here. It reduced the diversity of key microbes. And they say, you know, I'm quoting, these data reinforce the essential link between the gut microbiota and glyphosate toxicity in mice, and that the observed intestinal dysbiosis could increase the prevalence of neurobehavioral alterations. Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, this is a relatively new area of research as well. I say things are new if they're within the last few years. I'm not specifically sure which one that is, but I would guess that that's been within the last few years.
It's a 2018 study.
Yeah. There was another one also in 2018 that looked at rats and the effects on the microbiome, and, you know, found an array of different problems. And the scientists said, you know, this really, we need to look at this. This is what scientists are saying. We need to look more closely. We need more study, because these initial studies don't look good. And when you modify the gut microbiota, especially, you know, in early development, children before the onset of puberty, you could really be causing some problems.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, with the prevalence of gastrointestinal diseases and, you know, neurobehavioral problems in humans, that might be anxiety, depression, autism, cognitive decline and Alzheimer's, any number of things. And it makes sense because, you know, these agents work on plants. It is said that they don't work on mammals, but primitive organisms like bacteria, there may be a metabolic effect, and it may actually, you know, act like weed killer in the gut, you know, killing off certain bacteria.
Right. I mean, and that's certainly the thesis or the theory behind these studies, and this is what they're finding. I do like to point out, though, I do in my book and whenever I talk to people, we talk a lot about glyphosate. It is so widely used. It is so pervasive, but it's certainly not the worst of the worst. And if we get rid of glyphosate, we haven't solved the problem. We have an array of insecticides, fungicides, and these weed killers that are in our food and in our drinking water. There was new research that just came out recently showing atrazine levels in drinking water supplies and tap water in several states, including Kansas, where I live. We know that chlorpyrifos, which is an insecticide marketed by Dow Chemical, does such damage to young neurodevelopmental phases in children and even in when they're still in the womb. We know it's so damaging that our EPA has said we can't say any level is safe anymore. We used to tell you it's safe. We admit now we can't say it's safe. And yet it's still being used in our food and farming. So there's a lot of things out there in our food in terms of pesticides that we need to be cognizant of and understand what they're doing to our children's health.
And what I learned from your book is that Roundup is not just glyphosate. There's actually some adjuvants in there that may be suspect in and of themselves, some unpronounceables that are bundled in along with the glyphosate to amp up its effectiveness.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, research even by our own National Toxicology Program and researchers in Europe and elsewhere have found that these formulations, which is actually what you buy on the store shelf, a Roundup or a Ranger Pro, are much more toxic than glyphosate is by itself. There's a synergy, or when it works with these other chemicals, these surfactants, it's found to be much more toxic to human cells. And one of the surfactants that Monsanto was using for so long has been banned in Europe now because it's been deemed to be so dangerous.
And what do some other countries say about glyphosate? Is there pushback and resistance? And actually, I think there have been some cases where they haven't accepted shipments of U.S. crops because of glyphosate exposure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it varies from country to country. Germany, actually, where Bayer is based, Bayer, you know, Monsanto's new owner, Germany has said they're going to phase out glyphosate. They want to get rid of it.
Interesting.
France has said the same thing. You're seeing country by country a lot of debate. There's big debate in Australia right now, big debate in Canada. Countries driven in many situations by consumer concern are re-looking at glyphosate and rethinking its use in agriculture.
And what about the regulators? Are they asleep at the switch, or is there actual collusion? Because we know there's a revolving door down there in the federal bureaucracy where, you know, typically, you know, you have a job in a corporation, then you end up becoming a regulator and vice versa. Actually, one of the best ways to get a job in a company like Bayer or Monsanto is to have been a regulator. So you know the ins and outs of how to get, you know, past the regulators.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we know that there were very cozy relationships between certain EPA officials at very high levels and people within Monsanto at very high levels. We know that because of these internal Monsanto documents and because of Freedom of Information documents that I've obtained, and people that I work with, thousands and thousands of Freedom of Information documents that show conversations and discussions about, you know, essentially protecting Monsanto's interests. And you even see scientists within EPA, if they express concern about Monsanto's products, how they get overridden, how their supervisors basically tell them to be quiet and go away.
Yeah. And some of that pressure may come from Congress or from the federal bureaucracy because, you know, clearly there's a lot of lobbying going on to strip back on the regulations.
Yeah, the agrochemical industry has a very powerful lobby in Washington. They spread a lot of money around. These are big companies: Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, BASF, others. They contribute to CropLife America and other organizations that are very powerful and influential in Washington.
And they're growing and consolidating. Isn't there a Dow DuPont merger? You know, that they kind of, you know, joined forces. I'm thinking.
Right. These companies are consolidating and becoming ever more powerful. So now, instead of Dow and DuPont, you have Dow DuPont and
wow.
Monsanto joined with Bayer, of course, and Syngenta joined with ChemChina. I mean, you have the global giants becoming even larger.
Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is, you know, we talk about potential harm to humans. What about potential harms to the environment? I understand that, you know, I was happy to see the other day, I went out on a fall day to my house in Long Island, and I was really happy to see a bunch of monarch butterflies cavorting among my Montauk daisies. And because they're threatened, there is actually concern about the monarch butterfly populations. Is it possible that these pesticides and herbicides are affecting them?
Well, yeah, we know that glyphosate use has been negatively impacting the environment. We know that soil health has been in decline. Research studies have demonstrated that. We know that
the soil is a living thing. I mean, the soil has the soil has a microbiome. The soil has certain characteristics of living components, bacteria and fungi that maybe, you know, you may sterilize the soil in effect, and you have dead soil.
That's essentially what our scientists are finding. And so what happens then is your plants don't get the nutrients they need. They become ever more vulnerable, perhaps, to disease and fungus. And so then farmers are going to have to use more chemicals. Again, it's a vicious treadmill of sorts. But yeah, pollinators, the monarch butterfly, certainly, because of the loss of its forage, milkweed, and bees have been affected. Honeybees, we know they're affected by glyphosate as well as a different class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. You know, we're seeing water contamination. People don't think it's a little crazy when I say this, but our U.S. Geological Survey has documented glyphosate in rainfall and in air samples. I mean, this stuff is everywhere.
Well, you know, frequently the cry is junk science. You're going to hear that reiterated a lot. And, you know, they use that term in courtrooms. And actually, that's one of the ways that they sometimes try to overturn jury verdicts, because, like, well, you know, these jury people, they're lay people. They don't understand science. These are just claims. It's, you know, this is not hard science. What do you say about the claim of that a lot of this is speculative and, in effect, junk science?
Well, and this is their argument. Anyone whose science shows any sort of reason to have concern about their products, they label as junk science. Their science is the only valid science, and any science outside of industry is not valid. They've even gone after the elite of the elite, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is made up of independent scientists, a lot of them from government agencies, from regulatory agencies or health agencies around the world. People who specialize have spent decades in cancer research. These people looked at published peer-reviewed science to come up with their conclusion that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen. And Monsanto went after them and said, you're looking at junk science, you're politically motivated, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. The same thing that they said to the jury, they said about these international scientists. You know, it's kind of it's an old play, and I'm not sure why anybody would fall for it anymore.
Well, you know, I got to try something. And, you know, I've actually done expert medical testimony in trials, and I'm not going to do it ever again, because it's a miserable experience. Because if they disagree with you, they shout junk science. So you're very much in the tradition of Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. Can you remind our listeners of that legacy that you're following in?
Yeah, I actually, as I sit in my office, I have a picture of Rachel Carson sitting here. Her book, Silent Spring, really inspired me quite a bit. Excuse me, I have to take a drink.
Sure, do it.
You know, she looked at DDT much as I've looked at glyphosate. She warned about the risks of the indiscriminate use of pesticides and what it could do to human health and environmental health. And, you know, people listened to her, I think. She was a beautiful writer and a very intelligent researcher. Excuse me. And, you know, we saw the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency in the light of her work.
Yeah, some people don't realize that it's not always been around. It was only founded in 1970, I think, around then, during the Nixon administration, in response to some environmental pressure, and maybe part of it was in the wake of her campaign.
Yeah, I mean, this was in large part because of the awareness that Rachel Carson's work inspired. And I guess I make the point in my book, you know, we listened, but then we forgot the lessons of Rachel Carson. And you know, we need to remember, because we are endangering our future and the health of our future generations. We cannot go on like this.
You know, and I know your book, and perhaps deliberately so, doesn't wade into the debate about GMO crops in general. You talk more about the Roundup Ready crops and, you know, the nature of the use of pesticides that's enabled by GMO technology. But, you know, GMO technology is really taking off, and they're using new techniques like CRISPR to create all kinds of designer fruits, even designer animals, you know, livestock and fish. And do you have concerns about, you know, the potential mayhem that may be unleashed with GMOs?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I see the GMO issue as very broad and not as black and white as a lot of people have tried to make it. I certainly don't think that all GMOs are bad. I also don't think that all GMOs are good. I think there are risks and rewards associated with all of the different manifestations of genetically engineered technology, how it's played out traditionally and how it looks to be playing out now for the future for the next several years. And I think what we need is a real clear and truthful and transparent examination of these risks that come with the rewards so that an effective balancing of risk can be established. What has happened in the past with GMOs, we've heard all about the rewards. We've had these companies pushing them literally down our throats, and we've had the risks hidden to a great degree, much like what has happened with the pesticides. So, you know, we need our regulators and our lawmakers and others to start, you know, being accountable to the public and really looking at both sides of the equation if they're going to be protective of public and environmental health.
Well, you know, there's certainly a battle that's been enjoined, and part of it is a PR war by the promoters of this technology to reassure the public there's nothing to see here, sheeple, just move along. You, however, have raised some really legitimate concerns in your book, Whitewash. So what's today's intelligent medicine call to action? Besides, people should get your book, there's lots of resources there. What are some other resources that are worth paying attention to?
Oh my goodness, a trick question. I'm a beloved devotee of Food and Drug Administration and USDA pesticide program sampling reports. I'm not sure that other people would like to wade through those. I think that we really do need to be aware of pesticide residues in our foods, and that people would do well to educate themselves about that. There's some new research that's come out, of course, from French researchers showing that people who consumed an organic diet had a reduced lower risk for cancer, right?
And in particular, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It seems that that is one cancer that seems to be particularly, since it's an immune system cancer, one that seems to be particularly susceptible to chemical exposure.
Yes, definitely.
And we know it from industrial workers. We know industrial workers have, you know, exposures to plastics and, you know, synthetic chemicals create a higher risk of NHL. Doesn't stand for National Hockey League. It's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But, you know, other cancers, brain cancers, perhaps. But in that study, NHL really came up big.
And it did. Yep. It did. And I think your listeners, if they think about it for a moment, probably each one of them can name one or two or three or four or five people that they know with cancer or someone who's died of cancer. I know that I could probably name 10 people right now who I've been close to who've died or are living with cancer. We need to pay attention to this. Our scientists are telling us we need to pay attention and we need to do something about it. So however that looks for different people, sometimes it just means changing their own habits, purchasing or eating habits. Mm-hmm. For others, it means, you know, coming together in their communities to talk to school districts or city councils and say, let's rethink the pesticides we're laying down where our children play. Others, it means going to Washington, D.C. I mean, I've seen people around the United States taking different actions once they become informed. So that's my job, is to just bring information to light. And then it's up to everybody else to figure out how that is meaningful in their own lives.
And the take home for home gardeners and, you know, home landscapers is, you know, try natural methods of weed control and pest control. They're preferable to spraying harmful chemicals all over your property, and especially if you've got kids, and especially if you got pregnant moms walking around on the grass. And oh, by the way, when you retire, maybe don't retire to a golf course community, you know, where adjacent to a golf course, you could be exposed to a much higher level of chemicals. There's a reason that the grass looks so green and flawless.
That is certainly the case. That is certainly the case. And if you are going to spray these chemicals, now that I've really spent time looking at the dermal absorption data, that means you definitely want to wear, if you're going to spray them anyway, you want to wear protective gear. You don't want this stuff on your skin. You don't want to be inhaling it. You want to protect yourself. You don't want your clothes that have residues, you know, coming into your house and getting
on
your carpet.
Take your shoes off at the doorstep. I mean, yeah, things like simple measures. Yeah,
definitely.
Okay. Well, okay. Great book. Just a wonderful piece of, you know, honest and scrupulous reporting. You know, I can see you have great fidelity to the facts. You're not making it up. You spent a couple of decades amassing this information, and it's all there in Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer Cancer and the Corruption of Science. It's a case study in corporate malfeasance and the distortion of science. Thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations, and you know, keep up the great work and provide us with dispatches from the front.
Will do. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Carrie Gillum. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.